The subject matter of this podcast will address difficult topics, multiple forms of violence, and identity-based discrimination and harassment. We acknowledge that this content may be difficult and have listed specific content warnings in each episode description to help create a positive, safe experience for all listeners.
In this country, 31 million crimes, 31 million crimes are reported every year. That is one every second. Out of that, every 24 minutes, there is a murder. Every 5 minutes, there is a rape. Every 2 to 5 minutes, there is a sexual assault. Every 9 seconds in this country, a woman is assaulted by someone who told her that he loved her, by someone who told her it was her fault, by someone who tries to tell the rest of us it's none of our business. And I am proud to stand here today with each of you to call that perpetrator a liar.
Welcome to the podcast on crimes against women. I'm Maria McMullen. Death by drowning has captured public attention most widely in cases like the 1981 death of Natalie Wood, whose body surfaced in the Pacific Ocean 6 hours after an argument with then-husband Robert Wagner, or the death of Lacey Peterson and her unborn baby, Connor, murdered and dumped in the San Francisco Bay by convicted murderer Scott Peterson. Since that time, shocking cases of child drownings have made the nightly news, like those of Susan Smith and Andrea Yates, who murdered their own children by drowning. In what might have appeared at first tragic accidents, quickly became investigations into horrific aquatic homicides, a pattern of homicidal activity that occurs more often than one might realize. Today, aquatic abuse and homicide is a well-honed field of investigation that requires both specific training and crime scene methodology. Our guest today is Andrea Seferis, a medico-legal death investigator who specializes in the handling of aquatic cases from the crime scene to the courtroom. Recognized in multiple jurisdictions and by the U.S. Army as an expert witness in bodies found in water and aquatic death investigations, Andrea Seferis has trained dive teams, law enforcement, medical examiners, and many others for over 30 years. A member of the Women Divers Hall of Fame, Andrea is also an author, public speaker, and regular presenter at the Conference on Crimes Against Women. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
How did you first get into diving?
When I was a kid, I thought I wanted to be a marine biologist, so I babysat for years and at age 16 had enough money and paid for a dive class and took the class.
So it was kind of a sport at the time?
Well, I thought I wanted to be a marine biologist, so I figured I'd need to learn how to dive to do that.
I know so many people who aspire to be a marine biologist and end up as something else. Not any others that became aquatic abuse and homicide investigators, but other things. You're actually my first contact with that specialty. I'm really interested to learn more about it. So then, to that note, how did your interest in diving lead you to specialize in aquatic abuse homicide investigation?
It started actually when I was 16, and I took a rescue diver class from a man named Walt Butch-Hendrick, and then I took a dive master class from him when I was 18, and started working for him after I graduated from UMichigan, and he said to me about 30 years ago that he thought we were missing more aquatic homicides, and he called them homicidal drownings, than we were catching. And I said, what does that mean? So I started doing research in libraries, and discovered there was really very little information on aquatic homicides. There was almost no research. And, you know, what I could find in the literature really was, you know, the witch trials where women were, you know, dunked in the water. And if they drowned, they were innocent. And if they survived, they were a witch. So then they were burnt, you know, and found, you know, some cultures where women who were accused of adultery were drowned. But there was really very little contemporary literature, even though I have found some contemporary cases of women who were drowned because the communities thought they were witches in other countries. So in doing the research, I realized there was a huge need. So we were teaching thousands of people how to do public safety diving, how to find bodies and evidence in the water. And people started asking us questions. You know, they had a case, it was kind of weird. And really just what started happening was we started helping people on cases. And some of these cases had red flags and they got opened up as possible homicides. And some of them were prosecuted and got convictions. And about 25 years ago, a detective said, hey, I need you down here, and I have 40 detectives, and you're going to do an 8-hour class. I said, well, I don't have 8 hours of material. He goes, well, you better by then. And you know, since that time, you know, what's really frightening is every time I teach a class or speak at a conference, at least two people come up to me and say, oh my God, I have to go back and reopen an old case.
Wow. And
so for many years, that's how we were getting cases, where people were going back and opening up old cases. And now what's exciting is people are learning what to do, and they're starting the cases right the first time. So they're everything's getting done properly.
That's fascinating to me. Just to identify for us or define for us aquatic abuse homicide, what is that? What does that mean?
You know, there are different types. There are, for example, child abuse, where children are punished by being dunked in water or having water run over their face. Intimate partner violence. Apparently, it's been, it's something that's even possibly more underreported than strangulation. Women are being held with their faces under shower heads till loss of consciousness, or they're being held under faucets. And the thing is, it leaves no marks. No discernible marks. And how we're missing these things is, pneumonia would be a commonplace thing that these people would have. So if a child dies or a woman dies of pneumonia, 2 weeks later, no one's going to put the pieces together, especially if there's no reporting of it. But the homicidal drowning, there's eight different types. And just to give you some examples, one would be where someone is homicidally drowned, and then the death is staged to look like an accident or suicide in the same body of water. Sometimes the person is moved from one body of water to another. We had a case in Southern California where a woman was most likely drowned in the bathtub, and then her husband staged it as a pool drowning because the bathtub made less sense than the swimming pool. Or there's land-based deaths, which typically are strangulations, where then the woman is staged in a bathtub or in open water, and it's made to look like, again, like an accident or suicide. So then there's water-based deaths where someone is drowned and then they're put back on land. And again, it's made to look like either a natural death or an accidental death. So they're different types, different dynamics.
That's a very wide variety of dynamics. Are there any patterns in aquatic abuse? What do you see most often?
With the homicides, most of them, they're being staged to look like accidents. So the typical... I'll give you an example of a bathtub one. And this is one that I absolutely would have screwed up. I get a call from a coroner who is telling me that he's been trying to reach me for 5 months and he's been emailing me and not calling me. Don't do that. Call me. And he said, I have a 58-year-old female. Her past medical history is obesity, many cardiac problems. She's an alcoholic and a sleeping pill addict. And she's found dead in her bathtub. And she normally takes baths whenever she gets a migraine, which is frequent. She puts her head under the faucet in the bathtub and lets it run over her head. So her son finds her in the bathtub, which makes perfect sense. He comes home from work because she's in the bathtub all different times a day for the migraines. And the deputy coroner comes and they go to the autopsy. And here you have a woman who could have died from cardiac problems, could have died from the alcohol abuse. So many reasons that she could have died in this bathtub, that she could have been incapacitated in this bathtub. But the coroner said, I want a rape kit done. And everyone's saying, what are you talking about? There's no signs of foul play here. And he said, I was taught to treat every bathtub case as a homicide because he had taken my class a couple of years prior. So they did a rape kit and they found semen in her anus. And he could not get law enforcement to pursue this until he finally found one detective who looked at her financials, and it turned out all her money was gone. And it turned out that there was this man who had made a fake company, got her to invest all her money, and he took out several life insurance policies on her. And this was a homicide. And it was staged as either an accident or a natural death. But if that coroner had not asked for a rape kit, which I don't even think I would have done in that case, because it looked like an obvious natural accidental death, that homicide never would have been caught.
Wow. Was there an outcome to that case?
I have to call him back. This was probably about a year ago, so I haven't followed up with that one. But they knew who the guy was. He was calling in asking for copies of the death certificate so he could send in for the insurance policies that he took out without her knowing.
Was that an example of a pattern in aquatic abuse?
We're just starting to learn the patterns. I have several cases where it's the second wife that was caught. Take Drew Peterson, for example, where, he had two wives and it wasn't for the second wife dying. Kathleen Savio's case never would have gone to trial. If you get away with it once, you have to look for previous deaths in some of these cases. We have multiple cases where, the woman was found drowned in the bathtub, for example, and then you find out, and he had a wife who died of an overdose, 5 years earlier. So some things to look for are the men typically will stage it so that the woman has some sort of an addiction. So they're going to blame, her addiction on the incapacitation. So water can be used as a weapon, but so can toxicology. So if I'm going to drown somebody, I'm going to use toxicology to incapacitate them, but I'm first going to set up that they were an addict to begin with. So we really need to look at, you know, are they victim blaming? You know, and on cases where it truly is an accident or a natural death, the husband isn't saying, oh, she takes so many pills. Oh, she was so depressed. You know, they don't even want to believe that their wife is dead. So, you know, some of the red flags we look for is when they start setting up the woman as being an addict or, you know, suicidal, you know, to make it seem that this is an accident or a natural death.
So on these types of crime scenes, you know, when you're investigating a drowning, how is that scene investigated differently from others?
That's such a great question, because therein lies the entire problem. So let's take a land-based death. Let's say you have a woman reported found dead on the floor of her bedroom, right? Patrol gets there first. When patrol gets there, what would happen to that patrol officer if he picked up the woman from the floor and carried her outside the house and dumped her on the lawn? Would he have a job?
Would he have no.
He'd be in right. trouble, right?
Even so, I know that that's not proper procedure.
Right, exactly. So, you know, when you have a woman found dead in a lake or a river or an ocean, what happens? Well, the dive team, you know, a husband reports that the boat, you know, overturned and, oh my God, his wife sank and he couldn't get to her. So who's going to get called out? The dive team. And what's the diver going to do? Take the body and bring it out and bring it to the shore. You know, so we completely just broke the very first, most basic death investigation standard. It is, you don't touch the body. You don't move the body until you process it. But even before that, we're walking in the door with assumptions. So drowning is a diagnosis of exclusion. You can't prove that someone drowned with an autopsy. It's a diagnosis of exclusion. So right. if I tell you that a dispatcher would say, oh, you're going to a cerebral vascular event. No, a dispatcher would say you're going to an unresponsive female, right? But if you have a body found in water, it's really common for a dispatcher to say, oh, you're going to a drowning. Well, that means the dispatcher has done the autopsy, did toxicology, interviewed the witnesses, right? So every first responder going there, most of them are thinking, oh, this is a drowning. So we're assuming cause of death before we even get on the scene. And of course, that tunnel visions us. So you get there and you have this body found in water, reportedly found in water, because there have been multiple cases where the women were not even drowned. The whole thing was staged. And they just, the reporting party who was the offender said, oh, I found her in water. And that wasn't even true. So we assume they were in water. We assume that, you know, the cause of death was drowning. And then we don't process our scene. We grab the body up out of the water and we take it out without documenting body position. You know, what is underneath the body? You know, is that mark on the body because they were laying on a sharp rock? Or is that mark on the body because there was an injury from elsewhere? So we don't process our scenes. And even if you call in CSI, which rarely happens, what is CSI going to do? The body was in a river and it just got pulled out and it's on shore. What's CSI going to do? They're not trained. So, you know, if there's a motor vehicle accident, not only is the police detective going to go, there's going to be a crash reconstructionist who's going to go, who typically has hundreds of hours of training. If there's a fire fatality, you're going to have not just detectives and death investigators and patrol officers, you're going to have an arson investigator who has hundreds of hours of training. You have a plane crash, same thing, right? You're going to have a special investigator who studies plane crashes. But when there's a body found in water, there's no special investigator. So we walk in with assumptions, we move our bodies before we document them, we don't process our crime scenes, we don't have any special investigators that come in to help us, and very, very few investigators are trained in water-related, fluid-related deaths. So, you know, we don't bag our bodies before we move them. We just pick them up and carry them to the surface, and then they get put on the boat where maybe they get bagged. And God help you if you're a floater, because a rope is going to be tied around you and you're going to be dragged sometimes miles to the boat launch area. So, you know, there's a total of 17 reasons actually why I believe we're missing these cases, you know, the homicide cases more often than not. And, you know, those are just some examples.
Wow. I'm trying to process all of that information. It's incredible. So are you saying that most drownings are not processed as crime scenes?
Very, very, very few of them. And even when there's good intentions to process them, they don't know what to process. So for example, the eyes. The eyes are one of the most important things we need to look at. When you die on land, after 2-3 hours, you're going to start to get a drying artifact called Tashmore in your eyes. It looks like these little like black spots in your eyes because it's your eyeball's drying because you can't blink when you're dead. So when you pull a body out of water, you know, we had several cases where her husband said, oh, I found her in the bathtub. She was fully submerged in the bathtub. And, you know, she'd been, you know, she went and took a bath at 10 o'clock at night. And now it's, you know, 5 in the morning. So she gets pulled out of the bathtub. The first person on the scene needs to document those eyes, because if she is Tash Moore, she died on land and she was dead on land long enough for her eyeballs to dry out. But unfortunately, most people don't look for that. And that doesn't get documented till the autopsy. Well, that's 10, 12 hours later. The body's been on land. Of course you see Tash Moore. So if we're not trained specifically what to look for, you could have the best intentions. You're probably not going to document the key aspects of showing that, hey, this possibly is a homicide and not just an accident or a suicide.
That's incredible. What are some of the other phenomenon that are inherent to aquatic homicides? You know, pretty typical signs and symptoms that investigators could look out for. Because I'm guessing from based on what you're saying that many of the investigators who may have been listening to this conversation have not had the training that you speak of. So I'd love for them to walk away with an idea of what they should be looking for.
So we basically have broken it down into three questions to ask on every scene. And the first question is, does it make sense? So looking at the homicides, not just abuse, looking at homicides, does it make sense that the woman was found in that water at that time? So for example, let's say she's supposedly reportedly found in a bathtub. And again, don't take anything for face value. If you didn't see her in a bathtub and no first responder saw her bathtub, don't assume she was in the bathtub, even if the reporting party is telling you she was in the bathtub. So does she take baths? If she doesn't take baths, well, then that's kind of odd that she'd be taking a bath. Two, let's say she does take baths. When does she normally take baths? You know, for child abuse, the number one red flag to me is an out-of-character bathtub time. Because why was the child in that bathtub in an out-of-character time? Usually it's because something has gone wrong and they need to be put in the bathtub. So let's say the woman normally takes baths at night to relax, but now she's found, you know, that she took a bath in the afternoon. Why? So looking at her history, does it make sense she was in that particular water at that particular time? And you have to look at her history to see if that makes sense. Then the second question is, does the location, position, posture, and physical state of the body and the scene and the reporting party make sense? So if I tell you that I, you know, had to pull someone out of a bathtub or a swimming pool, or I had to climb down, you know, a muddy cliff to get her out of the water, I should represent that. I should show that. So we have to document our reporting parties. Where are they wet? Where are they dry? Where are they damp? Literally take the physical journey of the decedent, literally take the physical journey of the reporting party, document it, and see if it holds true. Because the ultimate thing about these cases is to do a reconstruction. Because if somebody is lying, and you get as much detail as possible from what they say happened, if you try and physically reenact it, it's probably not going to work. So it's critical that we get detailed information from the reporting parties and from anyone who potentially would be an offender. So does their location, position, posture, physical state, you know, dry, wet, hands wrinkled, feet wrinkled, eyes, everything, head to toe, does it make sense on the decedent, the reporting party, and the scene? And then the last question we ask, which is a huge question, is why she dead? Does it make sense that she would have not survived being in water? So it is amazing to me how many forensic pathologists will just be okay with the fact that a healthy 45-year-old woman was found dead in a bathtub. Kathleen Savio, people remember Drew Peterson, but I wish we'd remember the name of the victims, not the offenders. Drew Peterson drowned Kathleen Savio, and I believe in a toilet, and he staged it in a bathtub case. And I got to work on that case for the prosecution. And she's a healthy 47-year-old woman. Why is she dead in the bathtub? You know, they claim, oh, she must have slipped and hit her head. Well, you know, I can't find cases where healthy people slip and fall and hit their head and die in bathtubs. You know, the only cases I have where people hit their head and die in bathtubs are 86-year-olds who died 2 days later of a subdural hematoma. You know, if you fall and hit your head, what's the chance you're going to get knocked out? And if you do get knocked out, how long are you knocked out for? And it takes a good 5 minutes to drown to death. So, you know, even if you did hit your head to the point where you went unconscious and then you went underwater, you're going to snort up that water and that's going to really hurt and that's going to wake you up. So does it make sense that she's dead? And if it's just because you think she did a slip and fall and hit her head, that's a huge red flag. it more likely that it's a homicide than an accident for a healthy person to slip and fall. Dr. Craig Nelson, I love it. He says, neurologically intact people do not drown in bathtubs. Dr. Bloom, who was the Kathleen Savio prosecutor's forensic pathologist, I love it, the three Ds. If you don't have the three Ds, you probably have a homicide, disease, disability, or drugs. Why are they dead? So those are the three questions we ask on every scene that we can pass on to everybody.
That's incredible advice and information for investigators, for sure. So for a lot of these staged drownings or potential aquatic homicides, are most of them found in the bathroom? Is that the primary crime scene?
You know, I think right now we have more of those just because they're easier. And I think they're easier because of question number three. If anyone really thinks about it, why is she dead in the bathtub? I think once we get more and more people working the cases right from the beginning, we're going to see possibly just as many in open water. Give you an example of a case we had several years ago. And you know, the offenders tend to be, we have a lot of law enforcement offenders. We have doctors, physicians who are offenders. They're smart people. I think people who understand that if you're a non-swimmer and I push you in the pool or I push you off a boat, the autopsy is not going to show that, right? If I overturn a boat and you drown, the autopsy is not going to show that. So these cases are all circumstantial cases, and they require work. They require a lot of good documentation. So they're not easy cases. So here's a case of a man and a woman. They were married for 13 years, and he suggested that they go to the river on their property and have a nice romantic sushi and white wine picnic to celebrate the 13th wedding anniversary. And it's getting dark, and they drove their ATV to get to this river. And it's getting dark, and he says, and her name was Anne Marie Fitzpatrick, because I think we always do need to honor the victims of the case.
I agree. You're right.
And this was in 2012 in York County, Pennsylvania, if anyone wants to look it up. He says that he suggested that they have a campfire in order to have this romantic evening. And she says, no, according to him, always write report according to the RP. Don't say, write anything as fact if it comes from the RP's mouth in your reports. So according to him, he says that she says, no, I want you to teach me how to drive our ATV. Now, women, how many of you on this romantic night are going to ask your husband after 4 years of having this ATV, now's the time you want to learn how to drive the ATV in the dark? Yeah, not, right? That's just, you know, that's going to end up in a fight. That's just not going to happen. Not likely anyway. So he claims that she gets on it, he gets on it. And of course he had parked it with the stern right against right at the edge of the cliff that goes down to the river that's 6 to 8 feet high.
Right.
And, oh my gosh, what does she put it in?
Reverse,
right? Mm-hmm. So they go upside down and crash into the river. And he somehow, and that's the other thing, there's got to be a script that these guys find online. And he somehow made it to the surface. And they have all this detail about everything before that. But then they somehow, he got to the surface. He can't find her. And he's on this 911 call now. And he's screaming, Anne Marie, where are you? I can't find you. Stop playing. And all of a sudden he says, oh, she popped up. I see her belly. And then you hear splash, splash, splash. And he's calling her name. I got you, baby. I got you. And he takes her and he can't get her up the cliff. So he does CPR at, you know, on the bottom of the embankment, and then EMS come. And these guys are going to be treated as victims, right? Here's this shivering man who's doing CPR on his wife, and he's being treated like a victim, right?
So like a victim. Yeah,
totally. She gets pronounced in the hospital. They don't even do an autopsy because this is just a tragic accident. Case closed. The next Monday, her coworker gets on her computer and Outlook task pops up saying, if I'm not at work today, Joe killed me. So the coworker calls the police. Yeah. So if she had not left that message in Outlook, he would have gotten all the insurance money, which is what this was about. He didn't want to split up the house. He was calling his girlfriend on the way to the hospital saying, now we could be together.
Oh, so this my is a gosh.
Classic case. More than half of the cases I've worked where we've gotten homicide convictions, more than half were sealed, diagnosed as accidents or suicides. They were completely misdiagnosed. And if you include undetermined in those, gosh, I would say probably 70% of the cases I've worked were closed cases with accident, suicide, or undetermined as man or death, not homicide. And it's only because some freak thing, like an Outlook task. That's why these cases are getting open, because of some freak thing. Or now students who are getting the training, they're going back and reopening cases. So he did get convicted, and yeah, it was all about, he wanted to be with the girlfriend and he didn't want to split up the property. They had this beautiful house on the property. So she never even drowned. He strangled her and he beat her up and he got her wet. He didn't put her in the water. And there were so many red flags there. Bodies don't pop up before they gas up. You don't float till you bloat. And he said she popped up belly up. Bodies don't pop up belly up. You know, so if you understood the water dynamics, this was an easy one. But of course, the responders didn't understand the water dynamics. And they were, here's another problem, rescue mode. Everyone's going in rescue mode, right? So they're thinking, okay, what do we need to do? We need to save her. We need to keep him safe. If you're thinking rescue mode, you're not thinking, why is she dead? So there's at least 16 to 17 things that go against us in these cases if we don't have the training.
That story is so incredible. I'm just trying to process and catch up. And it's funny because I'm looking ahead and I was going to ask you if there was a specific profile of murderer that prefers to drown victims. And I was even going to suggest, you know, are they serial killers? But to me, it sounds like it's, you know, husbands or other men who want to get a woman out of the way. So they decide that drowning would be a convenient, easy way for them to do that. Is that true? Or is there a different profile?
Yeah. No, I think that is definitely a strong profile. And again, they try and set the woman up for either being suicidal or on drugs. And what's amazing is when toxicology comes back and she's not on drugs, then they get an expert to say, she had seizures from withdrawal. You know, she didn't have the drug. She normally took the drugs and now she didn't take the drugs. So she must have had seizures. So the other profile, though, I think we are going to start to see more sexual predators. I was very lucky. The Texas Rangers, who I think are the most awesome law enforcement agency in the country, one of the Texas Rangers had a case of a guy who had killed multiple women. And the first woman he drowned, nobody knew he even drowned her because the Texas Ranger did such a good job of, he had tried to kidnap a woman in a parking lot. And that's what got him to be arrested. He admitted to two other homicides that nobody knew about. And one of them was in the water. And it was chilling to speak with him because I said to him, you know, why did you, he had kidnapped this woman out of she was working in a gas station store. And I really want to put this out because it shook me up. He said what he would do to kidnap women is he would pretend to hold them up. And he would say, okay, you know, I need you to come to my car because if I leave you in the store, you're going to call police. So I need you to walk to my car and then I promise I'll let you go. So they would walk to his car and then he would say, you know what? You're going to be able to run back really quickly to the phone. So that's not good. Get in my car and I promise I'm going to drive 10 blocks. And I'm going to let you out there and you have to promise not to run. You're going to walk back. And he would keep stringing her along. And he said, you know, if any of these women would just say no, screw you, he wouldn't even have bothered. So that's something we need to be teaching our daughters and our wives and ourselves. But anyway, so he kidnapped her and took her to a deserted trailer and he rapes her and he tells her to get dressed and he tells her, okay, I'm going to get you in the car and I'm going to let you go. And he drives to a boat launch and he walks her into the water and he held her by the neck and he drowned her. And I said, why did you do that? You could have just, you know, strangled her in the trailer and not been caught. Cause he went into an area where someone could have seen him. And this is what he told me. And it was just bone chilling. He actually knew that he couldn't go deeper than his nipple height because then he wouldn't have control, right? Cause you have to have your body out of the water to have weight to hold someone else down.
Right.
I said, how do you know that? He goes, oh, you know, I've practiced that. I was like, okay. And he said, picture a boat on land. Can you move the boat easily? I'm like, no, you can't move a boat on land easily. He goes, right. He goes, put that boat in the water with one hand. You can move it anywhere you want, can't you? I was like, wow. You know, that was just chilling.
When you that is someone in water, chilling.
Yes. Chilling. Yeah. You have complete control over them because they're weightless. So as long That's as you right. understand water, you have all the power and you can move them in three dimensions. And, you know, talking, you know, because of Kelsey, we've been able to interview some women. One was a sex trafficked woman. And what was chilling was she was talking about how the pimp, when she was kidnapped and sex trafficked for many years, when some of the quote unquote girls did not behave, they would be sent to a pimp named Cosmo and he would waterboard them. And when they came back, she said they were completely broken. And, you know, talking with women who have had this experience, whether it's intimate partner violence or when they're sex trafficked, being drowned is possibly far more frightening than being strangled, especially for women that are strangled frequently, you know, sex trafficked victims who are strangled more times than they can count by, you know, predators, by Johns, by their pimps, because the strangulation almost, they know they're going to wake up, that it's almost becomes normalized. But when you're in the water, you're not fading out. Being in the water, when you're inhaling that fluid, it hurts. It's this dynamic reviving process until you finally die. I talked to a friend of mine who had a very abusive relationship, and I didn't even know this had happened to her. I told her about my work, and she said, well, yeah, my husband tried to drown me. And I'll never forget her words. She says, I remember being strangled. She was strangled, you know, multiple times over 10 years. She says, I remember being strangled, but I remember being drowned. It's possibly an even more salient, terrifying experience. Not that strangulation is not incredibly terrifying and horrible and painful as well.
Yeah, I'm terrified. And it's funny, you mentioned Kelsey. I wanted to also mention Kelsey McKay. I had the privilege of interviewing her recently regarding the topic of strangulation. And I understand there's some parallels between her work and your work and those two topics. So tell us a little bit about how you and Kelsey collaborate, and maybe even mention the upcoming web series that you're going to do for the Conference on Crimes Against Women.
You know, I've heard a number of people talk about strangulation. And when I first heard Kelsey, I was like, wow, this is amazing. I like things that are practical, things that you can physically go do that have been proven evidence-based. And I've never met anyone who has prosecuted the number of cases. As a matter of fact, you know, most of the people that talk about strangulation are medical. They haven't prosecuted. And, you know, I've actually learned a lot from her, from the prosecutor standpoint, how you ask a question. You know, if a patrol officer asks a question and gets an answer, if it's asked in a way, can I give you one example that really stuck with me from her?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Go.
So, you know, I, the first time I heard her speak, and she said, well, if a patrol officer asks a woman, you know, what happened? Oh, he was choking me out. Well, what did you do? I was screaming for him to stop. Well, in court, she's going to get treated like a liar, right? Because if you're being choked, you can't scream.
Yeah, right.
So the brain actually, when you're going through asphyxiation, the brain actually thinks you're not breathing. The brain's telling you you're not breathing. So she honestly believed she was not breathing, even though she was. So if the patrol officer just says, what were you feeling? And she says, okay, yeah, he was choking me out and I felt like I couldn't breathe. That's 100% truthful. Not that she wasn't truthful before, but she's not going to be able to be attacked for being a liar. She didn't say she wasn't breathing. She said she felt like she wasn't breathing. So the subtlety to that, because again, I'm not a prosecutor, that was really useful to me to, you know, learn how to ask a question so it's not going to be twisted and turned later in court, among many other things. So when I was listening to Kelsey, you know, the dynamics were so similar. One, women are not reporting, you know, if they survive, and law enforcement are not trained in what to look for. CSI is not trained in what to document, even if they are called in to document. The medical people are not trained in what questions to ask. And so I said, okay, there's just way too many similarities here. So what we realized was asphyxia as a topic needs to come together, because if a guy's been strangling a woman and it's been working, he's probably using other asphyxiation methods as well, like smothering or drowning. And interestingly, some of the people that Kelsey had given a form to were, you know, asking, were you ever drowned? They said no. But then when we started asking questions like, were you ever held underwater in a bathtub? They were like, oh yeah, many times. So we don't even know the language yet. You know, Kelsey has figured out over the years beautifully what language to use, you know, for doing forensic interviews. But now together, we're trying to work out what to use for finding out other ways that they were asphyxiated. Because if you use one method, you're probably going to use other methods.
Is that topic going to be covered in your web series?
Yes. The one that I'm going to be doing with her is, you know, how to get away with murder, homicides, suicides, and missed opportunities. I think that's part three. And then we're going to talk about part five. Let's talk about sex. And in that one, I'm going to be talking about something I called aquatic sexual sadism. And that is where the offenders get off on the drowning process. So they don't actually even have to have sex. So that, you know, just with the child porn, for example, it's getting totally missed with the software, because you have a picture of a child being held underwater. That's not going to get picked up by the porn software, because it's not what we would consider porn, but for the offender it is. And it's extremely deadly. You know, I've been doing some searches online and some pretty horrific porn sites, and I have found several videos now where women are being held underwater and, you know, strangled and drowned. And so strangulation and drowning seem to go together with these offenders. They're holding them by the neck in order to incapacitate them, and then they're holding their airways underwater, either under a faucet or directly in a bucket full of water or in a bathtub full of water. So what we're doing is we just see that the offenders are doing both processes. And so we're working together to figure out the best ways to identify them.
Well, that's an intersection I may not have ever thought of, but it's incredible. And I think the series is, and the listeners are really going to benefit from that. Have you been impacted at all, or your work been impacted at all by COVID-19?
So I work as a death investigator for a medical examiner's office, and I'm in New York, where we have a high number of cases. So a significant proportion of the cases I'm getting for just standard death cases, I'm amazed at how many people are COVID positive. And, you know, some of the people have lots of medical conditions, some of them don't. So it's not just, you know, the ill people that are dying. So we really, really have to be careful. You know, I had a 28-year-old, you know, so we have to be careful. What worries me, you know, I think which worries everybody is now people are cooped up together. And I, you know, I spoke with our local undersheriff not too long ago, and he said they're seeing triple the amounts of domestic violence calls. And the patrol officers I'm talking to when I'm working, you know, they're seeing more and more domestic violence calls. So I think that's a huge problem. So in that way, yeah, we really, and here's another problem, like New York City, because New York City has so many deaths right now, they are not sending death investigators to scenes anymore, unless it's obvious homicide. So they are actually using the transport drivers, the people that normally did the pickups on scenes for bodies to bring them back to the medical examiner's office, they're helping with the autopsies. So you do not have trained death investigators going to scenes in New York anymore.
So I'm speechless over this. I have a question just about that specifically. So what will happen long term then? Will the system eventually catch up with what could be potential homicides, or will this just all go cold?
You know, the people that are already dead, you know, the homicides that are missed, I think are probably going to stay missed. You know, more people are doing cremations. That's a problem. You know, New York City has trailers full of bodies right now, you know, refrigerator trailers. There's no way, you know, so even going to scenes now, up until COVID, there always was a patrol officer and law enforcement person with me when I went to a death scene, always. And now, and I understand it, they don't want to go in, some of them. And I totally get it. You know, a sergeant on my last call, the sergeant said, you know, do you mind if you go in by yourself? Because, you know, I want to minimize the risk for my patrol officers. And it was a benign scene. And I said, absolutely, no problem. But, you know, even for me, it was very hard for me to hold the camera, hold my clipboard, and move the body around to look at her, because I didn't want to put anything down in the residence, because, you know, we don't know if this is a COVID positive house. So there's no question that I wasn't able to examine the body in a way I normally would have. No question about it. Now, if I saw any red flags, I would have, but there's no doubt we're missing cases now. And I don't see how those are ever going to be recovered, because, you know, the scene's gone, the body's gone. So no question that we're missing more cases now than we were before. And hopefully when this is all over, you know, we'll go back to doing what we were doing before. But right now we've got to be missing more cases.
Our time's almost up together. So I have a couple lightning round questions for you. What is one term or term that you wish everyone would stop using, or one that you wish we'd incorporate more into our vocabulary?
I wish we would stop using the word drowning. I wish we would say body found in water, until a thorough investigation has been done. Don't make assumptions of cause of death. Just say, I have an unresponsive person reportedly found in water, if you didn't see the water yourself.
That's an excellent point for us to remember. What's inspiring you right now?
Because of Kelsey, I got to interview that the sex traffic victim, and she actually said thank you at the end of the interview, because no one had ever asked her about the water aspect, which was the most horrifying for her. And it just blew me away that, you know, there are women out there that are being tortured in a way that's not even being discussed yet. So they're not even being recognized. So that's inspiring me, that we need to keep going and getting these cases out.
Would you agree your work is intense? And if so, how do you combat burnout?
That's a really good question, because especially now with the COVID, you know, getting more deaths, and, you know, it's a challenge. You know, compassionate, I practice compassionate detachment, you know, from the, you know, the Asian standpoint. Burnout, you just got to keep looking at the light side, yoga, meditation, take walks, look at the sun, you know, and just know everything we do is making a difference. That's all I can keep thinking about.
That's great advice. Where can people find you to learn more?
So I'll give you a few places. One is you can go to our website, which is www.teamtemlgslimagolfsierra.com. I'll give you my email address, which is A as in alpha, Z as in zebra, at teamlgs.com. But the best way is cell phone. And I put this out. If you are on a scene, you can call me 24 hours a day. I'd much rather have you wake me up at 2 a.m. when you're actually on a scene. Not if you work the night shift, all right? But if you're on a scene, call me, because all I'm going to do is ask you lots of questions. So I'm going to give you my phone number and my partner's phone number.
Yeah, let's link it through your website.
Okay. And then my partner's name is Butch Hendrick. So you can also give him a call if email. If I don't respond right away, I literally, like Kelsey, have over 50,000 messages in my inbox. So call. Texting is great. You know, text and say, hey, I just sent you an email and you have not responded in 3 days. So text and call if you do send an email so I know that you sent it.
Andrea, thanks so much for talking with us today. This has been really informative and helpful. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you for all the work that you guys are doing.
While there is no definitive test to determine that a death was caused by drowning, there are often definitive clues. Investigators must be willing to look beyond the surface when a woman or any person dies by drowning to determine if foul play was involved. Often it's a matter of lack of expertise or lack of funding or both that can lead drowning deaths to be overlooked. And often, like in the case of the late actress Natalie Wood, it's a renewed interest in the details of a case that can change a ruling from accidental to potential homicide. When a woman is a victim of violence, whether rape, abuse, or murder, we must push for the facts of the case to be fully explored to determine the basis of the crime. Experts like Andrea Safaris and Kelsey McKay often provide critical links in cases that have or are at risk of going cold. To take a deeper dive on aquatic homicide and its relationship to strangulation, visit us on the Kakal web series with Safaris and McKay. Their series is titled Homicides, Suicides, and Missed Opportunities: How to Get Away with Murder. To learn more about this topic and other issues impacting crimes against women, visit conferencecaw.org and find us on social media at National CCAW. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, stay safe. Interested in learning more about the topics you've heard on this podcast? Listeners of the podcast on Crimes Against Women can receive $25 off of registration to the 34-part web series beginning on June 2nd. Visit www.conferencecaw.org/register and enter podcast 25, that's podcast 25, at checkout.